Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. This week, one of my favorite topics, the making of Candlewood Lake. It's not the original name of Candlewood Lake, it was actually Guardian Reservoir, and I guarantee you're going to learn a lot more fun facts about this lake, which is really just a hydroelectric project in western Connecticut. Well, we have two guests here to tell us the whole story from the lake's owner, First Light Power. Len Green is the Vice President of External Affairs, and Brian Wood is Senior Manager of the company's land holdings. They're going to be along in just a minute. First, this week's trivia question. What are hussars, and why were there so many of them in Lebanon, Connecticut a couple of centuries back? We'll have that answer for you, which, of course, doubles as the intro to next week's program, right after this week's program. And now, the making of Candlewood Lake, Connecticut's Disneyland. What's 11 miles long, 2 miles wide, holds 46 billion gallons of water, and covers more than 8 square miles of surface area? And oh yeah, it has 1,500 houses built along its 70-mile shoreline. Well, it's a hydroelectric plant, and it's called Candlewood Lake. A lot of people don't know the history behind Candlewood Lake, why it was made, what was there before the lake, and we're going to set out to answer all those questions in this episode. Now, less than 5% of Connecticut's electricity actually comes from hydropower, but the overwhelming majority of it comes from the beautiful Housatonic River due to a series of dams along the way that generate electricity and Candlewood Lake. First Light Power owns and manages all but one of those Housatonic River facilities. The gigantic generators inside the Rocky River Hydro Plant on Route 7 in New Milford make an extremely loud noise, and you're going to hear a recording of them after the interview. Today we have two representatives of First Light along to tell us the story of how the lake was built, which is just unbelievable, and how it all works. Len Green is the Vice President of External Affairs for First Light, and I'll be speaking with him first. And then Brian Wood is going to jump in when we talk about the actual building of the lake. He's the Senior Land Manager for the company, overseeing all the land in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Now, a company called UGI out of Philadelphia built the lake, and they did it in just over 2 years at an unbelievable cost, just $5 million, and the logistics were mind-numbing. Think of your kitchen sink, and imagine for a second you want to fill it up to the top, but there are gaps in the side, let's say a V-shaped hole in the side of your sink. Well, imagine that sink now is 11 miles long, 2 miles wide, and in order to fill it up, you have to go around the entire area, find the low point, find the high point, and build whatever gaps you need, dams, dikes, whatever, to make sure that you can fill the sink all the way to the top. Well, that's a very rough approximation of what Connecticut Light and Power had to do when they built Candlewood Lake, but the UGI team had to bring all that dream to reality. This is such a great story. You could start almost anywhere, but I think what I'd like to do is to start off talking about the guy who really made all of this happen, the guy with the original vision, John Henry Rohrbach. He had this vision of using the Housatonic River to generate electricity. What can you tell me about John Henry?
He was a heck of a guy, a man of his time, really. If you look at the era that he grew up in, we can still call it the Gilded Age, when you had some of these big names, the Rockefellers of the world, the Carnegies of the world, were still around doing their thing. And he came up with this amazing idea, you know, around the turn of the century into the teens. The man had quite the background. He was a very big figure in Connecticut politics. And he was an attorney from North Canaan. He had the party chairmanship of the Connecticut Republican Party for a couple of decades. And he saw this opportunity and had this vision that became eventually not only Rocky River, but a bunch of the dams along the Housatonic River that powered a lot of the industry we have.
At the time that John Henry Rohrbach is thinking about using the Housatonic River for hydropower, only half of the U.S. homes even had electricity. And he saw, as you say, all the mills that had been along the river and all the enterprise that had been created by using the river. And the fact that the Housatonic River, from its source down to Long Island Sound, drops 1,400 plus feet compared to Niagara Falls. It only drops 188 feet. And he was onto something, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why you have a series of dams along the Housatonic rather than, you know, one massive facility. Falls Village, way up north near the border of Massachusetts and Connecticut, that first station there, it's not the oldest, but it's the first along the river. Down, you know, you travel down to Bulls Bridge, which is the oldest facility that is on the Housatonic, and then Chepauk Station, and then Stevenson Station, and Derby as well. I mean, these were a series of facilities that were designed not only to capture this 1,400-plus foot elevation drop, but also to manage the river and basically be able to use the same fuel over and over again. The water comes downstream from Massachusetts into Connecticut and down into Long Island Sound. And as that water moves, you have multiple facilities that can actually take advantage of the moving water.
Okay, we knew how to use dams, and people had been using dams through the colonial period. But the concept of pumped storage, which actually came out of Switzerland originally, he saw and heard about that idea, and he said, I'm going to do that here on the lake and form Candlewood Lake. And this is, you know, I think very simple concept to sort of lay it out, that you take water from the river, you pump it uphill during times when people don't need electricity, you store it there, and then when they need it, you let the water go, and it comes back down and generates electricity. It's a great concept, and that's really what Candlewood Lake is, isn't it?
It absolutely is. We're here in the 21st century. It's almost 100 years, and people still to this day don't have a clue what it actually is. And when they hear about it, a lot of people, their first reaction is, who the heck thought of this? Why in the world would you ever think to do this? And Rocky River was the very first pumped hydro station in all of the United States. What it was before Rocky River was built and Candlewood was built, you know, these were tobacco fields in a valley. And he saw this valley as an opportunity to store a heck of a lot of energy and electricity for these different applications that people were coming into, going from oil lamps to light their houses to electricity. It was, you know, an amazing transition that happened actually relatively fast.
Yeah, we are definitely going to get into the actual building of it. One last point on how it works, because a lot of people drive up and down Route 7 on a daily basis, and they've probably seen that 13-foot wide penstock that goes from basically Route 7, actually goes under Route 7 and goes into the Housatonic River, and then goes up that hill, and they may wonder what it is. It looks like a gigantic straw, and that is the penstock that takes the water up and down. And just some facts and figures, 3,700 gallons a minute can be pumped up that penstock by these gigantic generators that are there. And then, because it goes a lot faster going downhill, of course, 15,500 gallons a minute go downhill, generating the electricity. When they originally ordered the 16,000 horsepower generators, my understanding is that the company that they ordered it from thought it was a mistake and called them up and said, you must have, you know, put an extra zero in there. Is that how you understand it?
To your point, they were shocked at the numbers that were being ordered. Essentially, when they got a hold of General Electric and Westinghouse, you know, reached out to them and Edison and other folks and had conversations, and the conversation fell out that, well, if we're going to build one pump, we're not really sure mankind can push water up 200 feet. It's never been done before. So if we're going to build one, we might as well build two.
The logic is unmistakable. Yeah. And the other thing is, as you're driving by that penstock on Route 7, nobody would stop and think, oh, wow, I just drove by Niagara Falls. But in fact, the penstock drops, I think it's, if I have it right, about 225, 230 feet. And again, Niagara Falls is only 188. So it's almost like you've just driven by Niagara Falls.
It's not as pretty to look at, I will say, unless you truly love hydro plants. But I used to drive up Route 7 and think, what in the heck is that thing and why is it here? And I had no idea that on the other side of the hill was Candlewood Lake. And I had no idea that that was actually meant for energy storage and electric generation. Most people don't. And most people who live in places like New Milford, where the plant is, still have no idea that it even exists. They just have no clue.
So let's talk for a second. Let's turn the dial now into how it was actually built, because this is a fascinating story of when Rohrbach decides, okay, and I think it was in 1907, he got the land deed where the dam was going to be built in New Milford. And then from there, it was back to the legislature to say, hey, look, I need eminent domain for Connecticut Light and Power. And because of his clout, he got that. And they were able to start first negotiating with the tobacco farmers and the other people who lived in these two villages. But it's a fascinating story of how they finally got title to the land and had to clear it out. Let's start with this. I mean, the workforce that they had to bring in and taking down all those trees and clearing it out to the 430-foot level. I mean, how did they figure out 430 feet? How did they figure out how many trees they had to get rid of? Just tell us that story.
It's pretty interesting. In managing the land for the company for upwards of 16, 17 years, I constantly might go back to those maps that were the actual acquisitions of the lands. And in reviewing all that and talking with surveyors and folks over my career, in New Milford on the green is a pin. And that pin is the Rocky River datum elevation. So they ran that elevation up through Lanesville, which goes behind New Milford High School, and up to Candlewood Lake to South Lanesville Dyke. They found bedrock in South Lanesville Dyke, transposed that elevation to there, and then literally a crew of, you know, 50 to 100 surveyors with chains and tapes ran that elevation all the way along the 70-some-odd miles of shoreline and started acquiring based upon those deeds. Once they established the elevations, they were then able to start the construction, design, specification, and engineering with UGI to start actually designing how many dams will we need, where would they need to be, and they poured these several earthen and concrete structures and established their elevations and started acquiring the associated lands.
So now you've got this level determined, and somebody has to come in here now and start taking down trees. So they hire, I think it was 500 lumberjacks to clear 4,500 acres of land. And while that's impressive enough, they did it pretty darn quickly. To go back to a point you were making earlier, Len, I think that this project was completed in something like 26 or 28 months.
Yeah, the sheer scale of the project is unbelievable. And especially if you think about how, you know, it was done with, they had mechanical tools and whatnot, obviously, but it was nothing like what we have today. They came in and, to your point, you know, 500 lumberjacks from, of all places, Maine. I mean, what better place to get lumberjacks than Maine? 4,500 acres of trees by hand and trying to clear this area in a quick enough fashion, after which you fill it up with water and turn this valley into, you know, Connecticut's biggest lake. It's amazing.
It truly is. Now, one of the stories that people love to talk about is the village of Jerusalem, which got inundated when they filled in the water. You know, obviously they took the people out in the cemeteries. We'll get into that in a second. The one that I think gets short shrift, I don't think people pay much attention to the fact that there was a village called Green's Pond in the Sherman area. As I understand it, of the 35 families that had to be sort of relocated with this project, 29 of them came from Jerusalem, which is why you probably hear about that more frequently. But there were six families who were in Green's Pond. Tell us what you know about those two villages and sort of taking them off the map.
Jerusalem was a small community, had a schoolhouse. That's why, you know, people know where it was, because it had a school system. The community up in Green Hill Pond, there's still a pond up in Sherman, is currently called Mill Pond. That's where Green Hill Pond was. And that community was tied into the streams that came out of Sawmill Brook and had mill industries and associated saw cutting and carpentry shops. It was more of a community where services were provided. All that stuff is visible on our maps.
There were 31 miles of road that were covered over with water. And I think that one of the things I love to tell people is you used to be able to drive from Brookfield to New Fairfield straight across what is today the lake, and used to be able to drive north and south. And all these roads were there, and people kind of look at you cross-eyed now and they can't believe that there actually were roads there.
It's funny you mentioned that. I was literally just at an event the other day with a bunch of realtors from the area. And one of the questions asked of me was, is First Light building a bridge back across the lake? Which at first I thought was kind of a joke, but apparently it was not. That rumor still persists, unfortunately. That's not going to happen anytime soon. There is no easier way anymore. But back in the day, there certainly were, as you said, 31 miles of roads. And they're still there. You just can't drive on them.
Yeah, if you got a boat, you can get back and forth pretty quickly. But that's about it.
The interesting thing is, you know, when you go back to the point prior to when we filled the reservoir, it was called the Redding to Sherman Turnpike. So you literally could drive from Redding to Sherman when Connecticut Light and Power decided to build the asset, they were asked by Connecticut DOT to figure out roads. And what ended up happening is during the construction of the dam, the company also acquired all the rights and then conveyed them out to Route 39 because there was no interconnect between Sherman through New Fairfield down to Danbury. So the worry was if Sherman ever lit on fire, you could not get to it from the city of Danbury. So Connecticut Light and Power created Route 39. The original Squants Pond was connected to Candlewood Lake. And they were asked to build a dam to create the thoroughfare that separated the two lakes. So we now have Squants Pond and Candlewood because there was no way to get the Danbury Fire Department to Sherman in the event of a major fire. So we created that causeway that separated the two reservoirs at the request of the state of Connecticut. And at the same time, you know, you're talking in the 1920s, they created Candlewood Lake Road that runs along that eastern shoreline, which was originally where Route 7 was supposed to flow. Both those roadways were created in order to provide that travel around the lake on both sides. Interestingly, until the probably 1950s, there was actually a power line that crossed from Candlewood Shores to Pine Island to New Fairfield. There was no way to connect the electricity from New Fairfield to the rest of Connecticut. New Fairfield would have had to get its electricity from New York State. So until the civil utility infrastructure went in, for some period of time, you couldn't sail a sailboat down Candlewood Lake without dropping your mast to hit the power line because the line hung across from Candlewood Shores over into New Fairfield.
Could we also just take a step back for a second to the construction? UGIville, so Oogieville, I think they called it, which is where the 900 men who built the dam actually lived and worked in like a small little town that had to be built to accommodate them. Can you tell us about that?
I have a photo of UGI Village at the main dam where it's got a, you know, concrete plant and a bakery and a barber shop and everything associated with the service needs of all the people who were working on the construction of the main dam. You can still find coffee cups in the woods because there were 1,000 men and women and families living in bunkhouses during the construction, and that's where they mobilized out on a daily basis. So, you know, you had Model Ts, which we have photos of driving down the old dirt roads while they were constructing all the roadways. The main dam was actually built with steam shovels because we didn't have the hydraulics that we have today. So they had cable-run, steam-fired shovels that they built all of the infrastructure with.
The other aspect of what had to be dealt with when the lake was built was the relocation of little over 400 bodies from cemeteries. I guess there were 6 cemeteries that had to be relocated. Can you tell us what that was like and how that was done?
My predecessors and the land group and the surveyors and the, you know, the people who acquired the land built those relationships with the community and had those conversations to identify where individuals had been interned and worked with those community members and neighbors and kin. And they worked through that process, working with the neighbors and folks before they left the valley. Churches, buildings, barns, historical valuable resources. A lot of times buildings were moved. A lot of the farmers in their deeds actually said, I have the right to take my barn apart and move it. And in a lot of instances, that's exactly what they did. You know, took their barn apart, put it on wagons, skids, whatever, and rebuilt it somewhere else in the community.
But if you actually do scuba diving today, you can go down there and find, as I hear it, bridges with guardrails and barns and even a Model T.
I do know from a diver who dove the lake for years, Ray Crawford, local resident in Milford, he said there are remains of a, you know, Model T. I know there's bridges. I know the majority of the barns were actually burned so that no one could then store or operate a tobacco farm out of that facility anymore. And then their, you know, farms were relocated as needed.
Amazing. Let's now shift gears and talk about what's there today. There were, again, some visionaries, some realtors out of Danbury, a couple of gentlemen who immediately bought up a lot of the shoreline and realized the real estate boom that would happen. And now you can barely touch, financially speaking, a property on Candlewood Lake because it's gotten so valuable. And maybe to put this in some perspective, I know there are a couple of houses on the lake that sell or are marketed for $5 million. That's what the entire project cost back in the 1920s to build Candlewood Lake, which is just stunning.
I think it's amazing to see, number one, the lake looked a lot different. There weren't very many trees around it. A lot of the areas had been cleared for farming purposes and whatnot. And today, it's surrounded by houses or woods. to your point, there were several people who saw the opportunity. I hate to say it this way, but a cash cow, and it's become more than a cow. It's become a whole herd of cows. You know, what you used to be able to initially were able to purchase for a few hundred dollars, some cottages. You could go with your family and enjoy summertime. Now is year round, and you have dozens of various communities, and it's become a humongous economic driver, not only for those five towns, but the whole region. It's a destination for people to come in and enjoy summer afternoon on their boat. It's also a fantastic place to own a piece of property and really have some stunning homes out there, many of which are far, to your point, far out of most of our price ranges, unfortunately.
You know, Rocky River Realty was the entity that acquired all the lands. Once they figured out what they needed to do to buy 6,000 acres in Fairfield County, they acquired all the landowners' lands. They then surveyed in the 440, and then the excess lands that were outside of that 440-foot elevation were subsequently conveyed out to developers. If you think of it, in the 1920s and 30s, they were building Disneyland. They knew that you could get on a train, you could get up to that region. People were coming up from New York City and, you know, enjoying the Berkshires, and on their way was Connecticut's largest lake on the train line. So they acquired all the land, sold off all those 68, 70 some odd parcels of farmers' lands. They all ultimately, for the most part, became lakefront communities. So if they acquired one parcel and then it became Candlewood Shores, and then it became, you know, each developer bought the excess lands above the 440, created a lake community, and really tied together a whole region of the state of Connecticut. But essentially, the western flank of Connecticut is associated with Candlewood. The other really interesting thing about Candlewood that nobody really thinks about, where else is there 6,000 acres of land open to the public, free of charge, that ties together five unique communities and provides this massive recreational resource to the region?
What was the original name?
The original name of the lake was Guarding Hill Reservoir. The main dam was created adjacent to Guarding Hill, which is now Candlewood Mountain. And it was a location where during the Revolution, they stood on Candlewood Mountain and looked down the Housatonic River to see if the British were making their way up to New Milford through Lover's Leap Notch. And when they created the main dam on Candlewood, it was called Guarding Hill Dam, and it was named as Guarding Hill Reservoir.
And of course, it's now called Candlewood Lake, and that's because of the Candlewood trees that were so abundant at the time on Candlewood Mountain. Native Americans used to use strips of the sappy insides of the candlewood trees as an early form of candles. The sap burned slowly and gave them a long light, similar to a candle. Now, as a special treat made possible during a plant tour with Brian Wood, I'm going to give you the sound of the huge generators as they're pumping water up from the Housatonic River into Candlewood Lake. Now, to put this into context, I was wearing special ear protection, but the sound was so deafening, I couldn't even hear Brian standing right next to me. It was a marvel to hear. Wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Candlewood Lake's been generating electricity with stored water energy for 96 years. As the First Light folks say, that makes it the oldest battery in Connecticut. I want to thank my guest for today's program, Len Green, Vice President of External Affairs for First Light, and Brian Wood, Senior Manager of the company's land holdings. The answer to this week's trivia question, well, the question itself was, what are Hussars and why were they in Lebanon, Connecticut a couple of centuries ago? The answer, Hussars traditionally are Hungarian soldiers, and they were part of the French force with Rochambeau that marched across Connecticut on their way to Virginia to fight that decisive battle of the Revolutionary War against the British, bringing the U.S. independence. Well, the Hussars' stay in Lebanon that winter was not without controversy, and we're going to have that story next week. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe and stay healthy.